Billy and I have just completed a 6,000-mile trip through the Pacific Northwest and Canada in search of magnificent natural beauty, and we found it even beyond our most fervent hopes. I suppose we saw it not simply because it was there, but because it was what we wanted to see. And I was reminded again a day or so ago how much our interests dictate what we see. When our 16-year-old grandson showed us pictures of his own recent tour of Germany, there were the usual shots of cobblestoned villages and cathedrals and castles, but about every third picture was of cars. West German Mercedes and BMWs and that little two-cylinder thing that the East Germans turned out by the thousands. He even had a picture of a Ford Probe struggling to keep up on the Autobahn. Cars, cars, cars. Because like most other boys at 16, Blue is more fascinated by cars than by ancient history. Here's a church, he would say dutifully to his preaching father and grandfather. Where is this, Blue? I don't remember. But the level of enthusiasm really seemed to soar when he held up a photograph of a taxi cab and said, "Grandfather, look at this big Mercedes. All these cab drivers whiz around in Mercedes and BMWs." Well, for his sake, I tried to care, but the pictures I held longest were of things I really cared about, lakes and rivers, mountains and valleys. Sometime this winter when I try to show him videotapes of my own vacation, Blue will probably yawn at the cobalt blue of Canada's Peyto Lake and ask me how our friend's Suburban performed and what kind of gas mileage we got. Exactly the things I was interested in at 16 when manhood and freedom depended on having wheels. But what I care about now is the beauty of wild animals and waterfalls, snow-capped hills and deep glacial lakes, because I am forever coming back to a pulpit, and because I think of how the glories of the natural world are described in some of the Bible's finest poetry. All of you know how God's creation is praised in the two creation stories of Genesis 1 and 2. But I invite you this morning to hear part of still another creation hymn, the 104th Psalm, which is not nearly so well known. I read it partly because it is so lovely in its praise of the created world, but even more to set the mood for some remarks I wish to make in a moment. What you're about to hear is a conflation of three of the best translations I know in English: the Catholic version, known as the Jerusalem Bible, the New English Bible, and the latest major translation, which is the New Revised Standard Version. Please don't just hear the dictionary meaning of the words. Put your aesthetic sense into high gear. Let the music of language have its way with you. Let each image shape itself in the gallery of your imagination, and feel, above all else, feel the writer's delight in the glory of the natural world. O Lord my God, you are great indeed. You are clothed with honor and majesty, wrapped in a robe of light. You stretch the heavens out like a tent and build your palace on the waters above. You make the clouds your chariot and ride on the wings of the wind. You make springs gush forth in valleys. They flow between the hills, giving drink to wild animals. Nearby, the birds of the air make their nests, singing among the leaves. The high mountains are for the wild goats. The rocks make a hiding place for rabbits. You have made the moon to mark the seasons and taught the sun where to set. You make darkness, and it is night, when all the animals of the forest come creeping out. When the sun rises, they go back to lie down in their dens, while men and women go off to their work and labor until the evening. Countless are the things you have made, O Lord. The earth is filled with your creatures, large and small, and the vast expanse of ocean teems with life. May the glory of the Lord endure forever. Wonderful stuff. How strange it is that the Bible embraces the intolerable dullness of parts of Numbers and Leviticus, and then surprises us with the 104th Psalm. And if you like that song, you would enjoy four closing chapters in the book of Job, where in magnificent poetry, God is represented as rejoicing in the wonder of his own creation, how the morning stars sang together at the time of creation and shouted for joy, how the great tides of the sea are restrained before they overwhelm the land, how the sun shakes out light across the dark world at dawn, how deep the sea is, and how no mortal has ever known the depths of it. Footnote: that last statement is no longer true, but we can't blame the ancient Hebrew poet for not having advanced knowledge of deep sea subs like Alvin, in which my granddaughter recently descended 2.5 miles to the ocean floor. Bound by his time and place, he could not imagine such a thing, so he wrote of the things he saw and of what lay within the reach of his imagination. He has his God speak of the mystery of hail and snow, of great storms and what makes it rain or freeze, of the majesty of constellations like the Pleiades and Orion and the Great Bear. Not that God is actually bragging on himself in this poetic drama, which could be offensive, but that the poet puts into God's mouth the overwhelming joy which he, the poet, takes in the world of natural beauty. So why start out like this on a hot final Sunday in August? The answer is that these were parts of the Bible that came over and over into my mind in past weeks during a journey through which we saw the grandest scenery, I think, in North America and the Canadian Rockies, out through Colorado, Utah, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and up into what even their license plates confidently proclaim as beautiful British Columbia. I have crisscrossed the Rockies from Colorado to Montana, but for sheer concentration of majestic beauty, I have never seen anything better than the 100 miles between Canadian Lake Louise and Jasper. soaring snow peaks and glaciers, deer and Rocky Mountain sheep, elk and black bears, porcupines and eagles and coyotes, and a wolf once, loping across a valley. And for several days on the lawns of our cabin just outside Jasper, we had elk grazing at dawn and dusk. When we needed a bull with antlers, because those fellas stay out of sight most of the time, to make our video complete, someone told us to drive out to Moraine Lake at dusk, and sure enough, we found two of them. I kept thinking as I reveled in that country of the lines from Keats, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever." And how much of it might have been lost when Banff National Park and Jasper National Park were both beginning to be despoiled years ago by commercial interests, until the federal government stepped in to preserve them forever for those who crave the solitudes of unspoiled wilderness. I thought of the current barrage of angry criticism of the federal government, and I whispered under my breath, "Thank you, Lord, for this particular intervention." I tried to imagine, as we crossed Glacier National Park on that incredible going-to-the-sun highway, what the author of the 104th Psalm would have made of it, or of the endless sky and immense lonely landscape as one descends some 300 miles from north to south down Montana's Interstate 90. I tried, not very successfully, to explain to the others in the car why that is without question my favorite day-long drive in all of America. How it is not so much just a long stretch of rolling country as it is a strange, time-arrested, slow-motion fall down the continent from the peaks of the Rockies to the flat plains of Wyoming, with the afternoon sun slanting across the rounded hills, stretching out the long shadows of grazing cattle, touching the meadow grass with pale gold, making me, frankly, as drunk with delight as anyone has ever been on drugs or alcohol. But the greatest thrill of all, for me, came on my birthday, when we pulled off the road because we thought we saw a moose. It turned out to be a wild grizzly, nonchalantly stripping berries, as close to our car as I am, Marion, to you, back there in that third row. Unlike grizzly sows with cubs, who are extremely unsociable, this huge male simply ignored the paltry human beings who had stopped to gawk at him. He didn't pose a serious threat that day, but one of life's lessons is that nature is amoral and can exact a terrible penalty from those who are careless. We stood on the lip of the thunderous Athabasca River Falls one day, where a young German tourist had just ignored a warning barrier, stepped closer to the edge to shoot a better picture, and slipped on a rock. In that roaring torrent, his life was gone in an instant. They had not found his body 3 days later, and in that long, wild river, I'm not sure they ever will. But sermon seed came from other things. Even from the questions you get asked when you cross the border from the U.S. into Canada, an officer strolls to the window, looks you over with a weary, practiced eye, and asks his brief litany of questions. Some of them, I thought, could be asked with other and deeper meanings in a beloved sanctuary back in Wichita. So here they are. "Good morning," he said. "And who has come today to visit Canada?" It was best that I was not at the wheel to give an answer about our identities, because I had already found myself thinking about the whole question of identity and how it's not something easily gone into at the U.S.-Canadian border with a line of cars waiting behind us. Fortunately, my friend Paul is a much more practical man who knows better than to tax the patience of border patrolmen. We are the McGees and the Myerses, friends traveling together. I didn't confess it to my car mates, but I was thinking when I get back home, I want to remind my friends at church of what they already know, of course, that identity is infinitely more than just names. We are nurses and teachers and lawyers and mechanics, liberal or conservative in politics, single or married, and it is even possible that there is a single definition overriding all the others. If one were to say, "I am a child of God," would that not color all the rest? Just wondering. "Where are you coming from?" he asked. And we knew what he meant, so we said Dallas, Texas, and Wichita, Kansas. But in my own eccentric mood at the moment, I think I had eaten too much chocolate. I thought of the other way of understanding that question. Out of what context comes your life? What are your biases and predispositions? How has experience shaped what you believe and hope? I've been trying to answer that form of the question in recent months, writing an autobiography for the children and the grandchildren. And it has seemed to me that we don't really know who we are or where we are until we look back to see where we came from. That is, unless we make it as simple as Chico Marx did once. When Groucho asked, "Where are we?" and Chico answered, "You can't fool me, we're right here." Well, so we are, always. But there are better answers than that, and this is one of the places where, from week to week, we have the great joy of being together while we look for them. "Where are you going?" the man asked us, and we answered simply, as he expected us to do, but this worship hour on Sunday mornings asks that question much more profoundly, knowing that some who come among us have no idea where they're going and have not thought about it much, while others are trying to find a home, not just a house on a street, but a place of love and meaning where mind and heart can be at peace. One day in London, on a reporting assignment at the BBC, racing down the stairs headlong, I bumped into a British movie star some of you are old enough to remember, David Niven. In the Oxford Book of Military Anecdotes, which he wrote after I had almost knocked him down the stairs, Niven recalls a true story from World War II about a British officer who was driving through Germany in the first days after the German surrender. This is how the British officer told what happened. I passed a farm wagon headed toward a village. I glanced casually at the two men sitting up behind the horse. Both wore typical farmer headgear with sacks thrown over their shoulders to protect them from a drizzle. We were just past them when something made me slam on the brakes and back up. I was right. The man who was not driving was wearing field boots. I slipped out from behind the wheel, pulled my revolver from its holster, and told the corporal to cover me with his Tommy gun. I gestured to the men to put their hands over their heads and told them in fumbling German to produce their papers. "I speak English," said the one with the field boots. "This man has papers. I have none." "Who are you?" I asked. He told me his name and rank. "A general." "We are not armed," he added, as I hesitated. I motioned them to lower their hands. "Where are you coming from, sir?" He looked down at me. I had never seen such utter weariness, such blank despair on a human face before. He passed a hand over the stubble of his chin. "Berlin," he said quietly. "Where are you going, sir?" He looked ahead down the road toward the village and closed his eyes. "Home," he said almost to himself. "It's not far now, only one more kilometer." I didn't say anything. He opened his eyes again, and we stared at each other. We were quite still for a long time. Then I said, "Go ahead, sir," and added ridiculously, "Please cover up your boots." Almost as though in pain, he closed his eyes and raised his head. Then, with sobbing intakes of breath, he covered his face with both hands, and they drove on to home. I am probably foolishly hopeful, but I like to believe that if someone is here on the brink of despair, brought down by the waywardness of a child, the breakup of a marriage, the death of a loved one, sick or fearful in the twilight of life, this place will sometimes be home. My favorite traveling companion thinks it would be much more relaxing if I did not do this, but when it is Sunday on a vacation, I always become aware of time again and start checking a watch or the car clock. I knew the very moment when John Conley or Bob Scott or the Kellys would be stepping into the pulpit. And acutely, I missed you. I am grateful this morning for the days of recreation which you granted, and to John and Bob and Jim and Chris for their ministry to you on recent Sundays. I come back having refreshed my spirit in the great tabernacle of God's created world, and I come back thinking of that great hymn which so eloquently speaks the gratitude I felt day after day on that trip. It's called for the beauty of the earth. And it praises hill and vale and tree and flower, sun and moon and stars of light, friends on earth and all the joys of human love. So I decided that on this first day back with you, I would like more than anything else to have you cap these remarks by singing that hymn happily. We will make it our closing prayer and walk away at the end of it. So please stand and praise the beauty of creation in the first four verses of hymn number 66.